Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast for the week of May 30th. And this week we're very happy to be joined by our neighbor from Fordham University, Peter Stifels. Welcome, Peter.
Glad to be here with you.
Now, Peter is the co-director of the Center on Religion and Culture at Fordham University and has an article in the current issue called Voice Lessons, Weighing the Moral Authority of Bishops. And Peter, maybe you can just start by explaining what the genesis of this article was.
Well, actually, I was embarked on doing an article on a piece by George Weigel that examines what he calls the Bernardine era and the end of the Bernardine era in American, recent American Catholic history. I was very dissatisfied with this article and wrote a kind of response. But there was one particular thing in it that intrigued me, and that was a claim by George Weigel that as the bishops' conferences, the voice, the moral authority and credibility of the bishops' conference under ultimately Cardinal Bernardine increased in the late 1970s and through the 80s, the voice or moral authority and credibility of individual bishops declined. And that struck me as curious. First of all, there's not that much voice. It's not as though there's only so much, quote, voice or moral authority to go around. And if the individual bishop gains, the collectivity of the bishops will lose, and vice versa. It's not a zero-sum game. That was the first thing that struck me. In fact, it seemed to me it could be just the opposite, that as the moral authority or credibility of the whole body of bishops grew, so would that of the local individual bishop in his diocese. And in fact, that rather fit in with my impression of what had happened during that time period, when before that, after the Second Vatican Council, it had been individual charismatic priests either leading civil rights demonstrations or disagreeing with the church about the new vernacular liturgy or sexuality who had been establishing the face of the Catholic Church in the United States. And in fact, then it was in the late 70s and the 1980s, in my recollection, that the bishops themselves as a body had sort of begun to set the agenda and establish the public face of the church and the nation more.
I'm just going to mention the name of these two articles for our listeners who want to listen to them, to read them. One is The End of the Bernardine Era by George Weigel, which appeared, I believe, in the February issue of First Things. And then your response, entitled Fabricating Bernardine, appeared in the May 20th issue of Commonweal. And we will put links to both of those articles up. But let's get back to this whole question of individual bishops versus bishop conferences. Maybe you can just get a brief history of how the bishops' conferences were created. This was following Vatican II, correct?
That's right. Of course, throughout the church's history, there's always been a place for gathering of bishops from certain areas, regions, or nations to act in concert. But the Second Vatican Council gave a new authority to these local national conferences, expecting them to take on certain tasks, and particularly in the area of liturgy, where they had a much stronger authority to have a common liturgical practice for a nation, but also to speak with one voice on kind of social and cultural issues. Now, ever since then, there have been considerable discussion and debates as to the extent and degree of that authority of local conferences. But it is something that has been certainly developed since the Second Vatican Council. And in the United States, it really developed under the auspices of Cardinal Dearden of Detroit, particularly in the 1970s.
Originally it was called the National, it had a different name than it does now, correct?
Yes, it's now called the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops. Originally they had a title the National Conference of Catholic Bishops, I believe, and then the U.S. Council, I'm not really sure of it, but they made a division between their more internal church activities and their public persuasion and leadership in civic affairs. And a few years ago, they decided that that was both hard to understand and organizationally ungainly, so they combined them again.
Now, the conventional wisdom seems to be that kind of the peak of their influence of the bishops was these letters in the early 1980s, the challenge of peace being won, also the pastoral on the economy. You were at Comwheel at the time, I believe, and then also later at the New York Times, so you had kind of a firsthand look at the growth of the Bishops' Conference during this time.
That's right, particularly, well, in the 1970s when it was really getting underway, a good bit of that era, I was actually working in the field of bioethics, and so not so closely watching Catholic events itself, but from the late 70s to through the 1980s, I was following their public discussions where they had a major place in the national debate about such things as the morality and practicality of our nuclear defense policies and the wisdom of our economic policies.
Now, you note in your article there's a bit of a wrinkle here in that the U.S. Bishops' Conference, the leaders of that conference are elected by the bishops in the United States, of course, whereas the what might be regarded as the kind of the prominent other leaders within the church, the cardinals, are appointed by Rome. So you have a little bit of a tension there between who is the quote-unquote the leader of the American church.
That's exactly right, and it's an issue of who's going to be the key intermediaries between the Vatican and the American hierarchy. And on the one hand, it's always more convenient for all of us to have our intermediaries to be people that we've appointed ourselves. On the other hand, it's actually perhaps more representative and effective if the intermediaries are those who are elected officers of the National Conference of Bishops. And this tension has existed all along, but I would say that during the period when Cardinal Bernardine had a prominent role in church leadership, certainly up through the middle of the 1980s, the tendency was for the elected officials to have more of a place in that kind of discussion. And the cardinals, who had traditionally, we think of people like Cardinal Spellman and so on, who had traditionally been the face of the church, that their role did diminish somewhat.
It's very interesting. Now, the last two terms, including the current president, Archbishop Dolan, you have people in those positions, Cardinal George before him, who are coming for the more prominent sees in the United States, where that traditionally was not the case.
I think that's right, yes.
You pose a question here in your piece, which we use as a pull quote, so maybe I'll pose it to you directly. Is there a relationship, kind of an inverse relationship, between effective leadership of the bishops' conference and that of individual bishops? That's the key question you're posing here, and you end by saying there needs to be more research, but what did you find while you were researching this piece?
Well, the interesting thing here is that in examining this question that was really raised by my disagreement with George Weigel's formulation, I began to wonder if my own view, which I outlined just a few minutes ago, was the correct one. And what made me wonder about this was a paper that had been presented by a young historian of religion in the United States, Jim McCartan, about the public developments over a number of controversies regarding treatment at the end of life. And in these cases, bishops who were the bishops of the diocese were controversies about continuing treatment of various people who were in the last stages of life, issued statements that were rather measured and qualified and based on traditional distinctions in Catholic theology between ordinary and extraordinary medical treatment. But at the same time, the pro-life movement activists who were very concerned about any kind of possible tendency toward the legitimation of euthanasia because of withdrawal of treatment issued their own statements, and in some ways the media anointed the pro-life activists as more the public voice of the church than the local bishops. This was the picture that McCartan drew in what he would, I think, agree was kind of a preliminary study of these early controversies. And that raised the question in my mind about whether my own view was correct, although it didn't really particularly substantiate George Weigel's view either. And I do go on to say, you know, this is really a question, and there's probably three or four other views, but one that we all ought to be interested in, and especially the bishops themselves.
It seems that this question comes up every election cycle because you have, you know, every 4 years you have a statement from the bishops, faithful citizenship, which lays out some of the issues that Catholics should consider as they're going to the polls. And it usually strikes kind of a nonpartisan tone. Yet there's also been some controversy, especially when John Kerry was running for president, when individual bishops were making statements about questions of whether there should be denial of communion, etc. So there has been some tension there that has been manifested, particularly on this question of Catholic politicians.
I think the bishops have always struggled with this question about whether they have individual bishops taking strong public positions that seem to be at odds with the consensus. And because of that, in their public positions, they put a great deal of emphasis on consensus. And some people argue, well, it makes their positions, their public positions, bland and not sufficiently prophetic. And I honestly don't know the answer to this question, to what extent, looking at this from the point of view not of agreeing or disagreeing with a given bishop on a given position, but to what extent the expression of disagreement and debate among the bishops strengthens or weakens their position as a whole. After all, when we see elections in other countries where the leader of the country is voted into office by a 98% approval rating, we don't take that very seriously. So if the bishops had polite ways of even publicly, rather than just behind closed doors, disagreeing, we would take both the disagreement and the overall view of the bishop's body more seriously. That's the kind of question, you know, in all honesty, I'm not completely decided on. I wrote this article because I began thinking about it and I wanted to pose it to others.
Maybe we can move to another issue that is certainly perhaps harmed the credibility, I think definitely harmed the credibility of the Catholic bishops in this country, is the sexual abuse scandal. How has that affected the voices of bishops in this country?
Well, of course, for the most part, the sexual abuse scandal is something that postdates, at least not the question of abuse itself, but the question of the bishop's response to it and whether that was adequate and so on. That postdates the era when Cardinal Bernardine was most influential among the hierarchy. But when I look at that, it seems to me that it supports the idea that a stronger collective response from the bishops' conference actually strengthens the moral authority and credibility of the individual bishops, because the conference here was unable to, in my view, act in a satisfactorily strong way once the issues of sexual abuse of minors by clergy had come to the fore in the middle 1980s. And I think that in the end, that inability to act collectively and firmly had a terrible consequence for the moral credibility of the individual bishop, regardless whether he was from a diocese that had had a considerable extent of these kind of problems or not. You saw a spillover event, effect at what became front page news in one part of the country affected Catholics and Catholic bishops all over the nation.
Well, we're talking about the question of voice, and one issue that's raised by George Weigel in his article is, you know, what issues the bishops should be speaking on. And his opinion is that they should be limited to issues where they really have something strong to say, that they should not be commenting on every political international issue. I guess that's an interesting question as to, you know, does that perhaps, I mean, it might be his point, dilute the voice when you're saying something on every public policy position?
Well, I think it's important here to distinguish between the kinds of positions that bishops articulate on the moral dimensions of things that have come to the public attention that are in the civic square, and I distinguish between those and positions that the bishops take on the legal or political aspects or the policy-making aspects of what are moral questions. Frankly, I think the bishops should speak. They should give their views on the latter as well as the former, but I think they should stick to the position that they themselves outlined when they were writing those letters on especially nuclear defense and then later the economy, that the moral principles are something that they address with great authority, whereas the applications, the translation of those moral principles into the law or policy for a religiously and politically diverse question is something where they give it, they make their best effort, but they cannot speak there with the same kind of authority. It requires a degree of expertise or a lot of judgment calls that depend on particular circumstances. So I would agree that the bishops should not make too many interventions in political or policy matters. I think that there are crucial questions that are similar to the issues. I think the nuclear defense and war and peace are life questions that are similar to the ones we're familiar with about abortion primarily and stem cell research. But I think in all those questions, the important thing is that they keep in mind the levels of clear moral teaching on the moral dimension and the less clear teaching on the political and policy dimensions.
Now, you've been, as we said earlier, following the Bishops' Conference for some time now, and every so often you continue to go to some of these meetings that they have every year, twice a year. What's your sense of their ability to kind of, you know, in this media environment, to get through to an audience that has so many, you know, Catholics who may not, for example, know who their bishop is, may not know about documents like faithful citizenship? So kind of getting through to the individual Catholics in this media environment would seem to be very difficult. Is there some strategy they're taking, or I assume they're aware of this problem?
Well, I'm not sure how aware they are of this problem, and I have to say that I haven't been as closely following the bishops' conferences activities in recent years as I did when I was a religion reporter for the New York Times, or working on a book I did called The People Adrift on the State of the Catholic Church in the United States. I think this is a real challenge that they know, or they should know, that what they do is going to go through the filter of the news media, and that that filter, as a member of, as a longtime journalist, that filter does have its prejudices and its biases and its tendencies to want to emphasize conflict, its interest in a certain range of issues, especially those having to do with sexuality. And I think you have to consciously think, this statement we're going to make, if we want it to get through to people, how are we from the very get-go going to frame things so that it can best as possible skirt around those biases that are built into the media filters.
Well, finally, maybe we can end by just talking about your work at Fordham University at the Center on Religion and Culture. You sponsor various events, bring in speakers, have lectures, conferences on questions of ethics and questions of culture. How does the bishop's statements and what the bishops have to say, how does that impact what you do?
Well, we address a whole range of questions where we want to bring the serious attention and thoughtful attention to the religious dimensions of things that are on the public agenda. And they've ranged everywhere from religion and electoral politics and religion and our overseas interventions and religion and science and religion and art, religion and literature, and so on. So many of those are not areas where the bishops have made statements, but some of them, for example, having to do with electoral politics or our overseas interventions, the bishops have. Most of our discussions have an interfaith aspect, but we give a certain privileged position and prominence to a range of Catholic analysts and experts on these questions. But your question points me right in the direction of what we're up to in the fall, since this is, alas, I say in certain ways, the beginning of the presidential election cycle already. And the bishops will most probably be issuing or reissuing or doing something in terms of their tradition of a statement in November before the presidential election year, trying to help Catholics think about how their faith relates to their political choices. In anticipation of that, we are going to have not one but two public forums on the faithful citizenship, and one of them on the document itself, its history, how it looks and how it's worked, and how it's analyzed by people from both the more conservative and the more liberal parts of the political spectrum. And then another forum, that one in September, and another forum in October, where we don't worry so much about the bishops and just look at how politicians and voters can really try and be faithful citizens amidst the hurly-burly and the negative advertising and all the spin and exaggeration of a election cycle.
Well, Peter Steinfels, we want to thank you again for coming. Article in the current issue. Also, of course, we'll recommend your book, A People Adrift, The Crisis of the Roman Catholic Church in America. And if you want to read more about some of these questions, that's a great resource. So we want to thank you you're not far away for coming down and joining us.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you.
I want to thank you again for joining us for this week's podcast and remind you to look online for our other web-only features, including video reflections for the Easter season. We also have a review of the HBO film Too Big to Fail about the financial crisis. A reminder that you can respond to our podcast at americamagazine.podbean.com. This is Tim Reedy for America Magazine.